Coronavirus still a thing in 2021.
Boo!
Morrison leaves millions of Australians behind.
So much boo!
And the good news is on electric cars.
Yay!
This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your host, Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is the lovely, delightful, the red rose of socialism in her hair, Van Badham. Happy New Year, Van, and
I'm
welcome.
I'm so lucky to have you. Hello, welcome to our shed with our dog.
That's right. Welcome to 2021 on The Week on Wednesday, and they said we wouldn't make it past the first week. Well, here we are. It's months now we've been doing this show. We did have a couple of weeks off.
We did have a couple of weeks off, and as you know, we both ate our body weight in pies and chocolate, and it was very good.
It was lovely. Now,
a big shout out to our friend Lachlan, who's from New South Wales and got trapped in the state of Victoria because of all the coronavirus madness, who turned up just in time to joint the turkey.
Yes, indeed. It was a Christmas miracle, wasn't it? But, of course, unfortunately, the reverse of a Christmas miracle was the fact that coronavirus is still with us and there are some question marks about vaccines, both overseas and here in Australia. But, of course, the reality is that coronavirus hasn't gone away just because we've had Christmas, has it, Van?
No, and I wanted to talk about this because I've noticed, and I think maybe I even noticed in myself a bit of hopeful, magical thinking that, oh, well, 2021, there's a vaccine, the virus is going to go away and everything's going to go back to normal. That hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Because there have been numerous developments. As we're learning, coronavirus is extremely brilliant as a virus, a highly effective virus.
Keeps mutating, keeps changing.
And this is causing all kinds of problems. So the big news is that in September, a new variant of the virus was discovered in Britain, in Kent. And somebody went, hang on, this is something's happened. And, of course, the nature with viruses is that they do mutate, they evolve, they change. They have responses to proteins in people's bodies and then they're passed on to other bodies and these things happen. Things come along that wipe them out. They evolve, they adapt, they change, they develop critical mass populations, all kinds of things.
Because they're actually a living thing. A virus is a living thing.
I'm sure everyone listening to this show knows that, but obviously lots of people on the internet are not getting it. So they are not microchips. In fact, this is one of my favourite pieces of news this week. There was a viral post going around the anti-vaccine, anti-5G community. So we're at the conspiracy theory singularity where every conspiracy ever is now becoming part of like a grand conspiracy narrative. And the conspiracy theory goes that George Soros and Bill Gates are in cahoots and that coronavirus is not real despite all those, you know, more than a million people have died. And it's just a front to inject us with vaccines that contain a microchip that's 5G technology. It's completely mad. Obviously, none of this is true. But someone realised that the electric circuit board of the chip that was this 5G chip is actually from a wah-wah pedal. Like it's
right.
It's beautiful. So if we're being injected with wah-wah pedals, I reckon that's great. Like bring it on. If rock gets us through coronavirus, like I'm 100% in. But of course, the real situation is that this virus is a devil of a thing. And in Britain, what happened was they noticed this variant. The variant actually surfaced a little earlier in the Netherlands and in Denmark. And what happened in the Netherlands was that their infection rate just spiked. They had it relatively under control. They'd reopened parts of their economy. Bang, this massive increase in cases. And they've been in hard lockdown. They've had a 5-week hard lockdown in order to try and restrict the spread. And these cases have been turning up all over the world, like various, they're getting picked up through hotel quarantines. And that's what happened in Australia, was that this particular variant was discovered in people who had made international flights to Australia. And our scientists were like, hang on, this is different. Same thing happened in Japan. The same thing happened in Singapore and in Canada. And so alerts went out going, we have a problem. Well, it's Britain that's really had the problem because this new strain of the virus is 70% more transmissible.
I mean, that's huge, isn't it? When we think about the fact that coronavirus, the original strains, if you like, if you want to call them that, were already considered among the most transmissible of viruses that were from the sort of COVID class of virus, now to have it increase its transmissibility even further is a real danger. And of course, we're seeing in the UK, the health service being starting to be overwhelmed, aren't we?
Completely overwhelmed. And this is the problem. So at the moment, one in 50 Britons has coronavirus.
And it's one in 30 Londoners.
One in 30 Londoners. And as somebody who lived in London for 10 years and who, because I had swine flu, I love telling people I had swine flu. And my experience of swine flu was that I got it at the beginning of the swine flu epidemic and then the virus mutated and I got it again at the end of the pandemic. So I had swine flu twice and it was terrible. And this, like, London is an old city. It's a dirty city. Mm. It's a crowded city. It's a city where, you know, if you're a foreigner like me, you pick up flus and things all the time because of, you know, the situations you live in, the fact that you weren't raised in that germ environment and the rest of it. And for me to read that one in 30 Londoners has coronavirus is terrifying because the way that city is set up, you know, with all the underground tunnels and everybody, I mean,
it's close proximity.
Everybody's packed in.
You're on top of each other.
Yeah. I mean, you can only last 5 days in that particular environment before your notorious urban claustrophobia kicks in and we have to run out screaming to the countryside. So it is really, really frightening. And of course, they're looking at 70,000 cases a day, a day at the moment.
Boris Johnson says a million people in the UK have coronavirus.
It is terrifying. And Boris Johnson is in charge. Yeah. It's really quite funny. I was reading an interview with Armando Iannucci, who you and I both love, who's the writer who made Veep.
And
The Death of Stalin, which is one of our favourite movies. And obviously, and hilarious. Totalitarianism. what japes. But he was talking about Avenue 5, which is this show with Hugh Laurie and Josh Gad and a whole bunch of other people that he's
made. Another great show,
And he was talking about it and he was saying the thing about Avenue 5 has become one of the most relevant pieces of art on the planet because it's about thousands of people trapped in an enclosed space with no leadership.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, my God, that's England.
Yeah.
Like, and this has been the problem. I mean, before Christmas you had Boris Johnson going, oh, well, we'll just take Christmas. We'll just go back to normal for Christmas. I mean, we can't live with everything locked down. We're Britain and we'll just stiff up our lips. And it's like, love, this ain't the Blitz. We're not playing football in no man's land in World War One either. Like, the virus doesn't care. And of course, things have just been out of control. Where that leaves Australia and where that has left Britain is that with the virus raging, they're trying to run a vaccine schedule. You know, we have these vaccines. We know that they work. We know that they're effective. But political decisions are influencing vaccine scheduling in the UK. So there was a story this week about how the scientists have said, and the way the trials have been run is that you do your vaccine and then you do your booster shot in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
Well, they don't have enough vaccines and now the virus is running crazy again. Boris Johnson has pushed back the vaccine delivery by 3 months and scientists are concerned. American scientists were concerned that this means that this will give the virus a window to mutate. So it can stay more transmissible. So unfortunately, the science has been extraordinary about dealing with coronavirus. We know the vaccine is safe. We know that it's effective. We know everybody wants one.
In record times. They've done this
in record times. And, well, I mean, why wouldn't they? I mean, it's the world's a disaster area.
Put the resources into something and you can actually get stuff done.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah, if you invest government resources into targeted programs that involve people around a sense of community responsibility, they come to, I mean, how crazy. It's almost like socialism works. And what's happened, of course, is that political decisions are now influencing these because they don't think they've got enough vaccinations. They want to spread them around so people. So the idea is that more people will get possibly a less effective vaccine with a more delayed schedule, which could, in fact, enhance the problem. They don't know, but the whole idea is that it's supposed to be a science-led process.
And we're seeing this in Australia just today with Greg Hunt talking about changing the rollout timetable for the vaccine here in Australia. Originally, they were talking about late March. He's now saying, no, we're going to do it in early March. Therapeutic Goods Administration, which is the body in Australia which determines the safety of these things, has not actually yet approved these for distribution. So even though they've had emergency approval in the UK and the US and in some other places based on really on solid but early clinical trials, The Therapeutic Goods Administration has not yet approved them here, and yet we see that same level of, if not greater level of political interference with Greg Hunt saying, no, the first 2 weeks of March is when we're going to roll out vaccines here in Australia.
Well, you also have political calls. Albanese wants the vaccine out earlier.
Yeah.
Like, of course, there's political pressure on all sides.
Yeah.
And there's this desperate hope that we can all just wake up out of coronavirus because it's 2021, guys. Like, and that means everything. Lovely. Like, I've bought a new Star Trek calendar. Like, everything is different. And it's like, no, everything is not different. The virus is still very much with us. We know it's mutating. We know that as long as you have countries run by the likes of Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. So in America, the vaccine rollout is a complete disaster, a complete disaster. Totally mismanaged. It's not centralised at all. It's been devolved to the states. And the states, so this has been, this was also Scott Morrison's strategy, that we've got a crisis. It's all a bit hard.
Let's leave it to the states.
Let's parcel it out to the states. So that's what Donald Trump did. So Morrison followed Trump's lead and the states can deal with it because, you know, those borders are so permanent and fixed and oh my God. So now the states in the United States have devolved it out to the counties.
Oh my God.
So the counties are distributing the vaccines. And of course, as anybody who's watched American electoral coverage obsessively like Lunatics knows, counties in the United States are very different. Like they're not standard sizes. They don't have standard demographics. Like they can have vast amounts of geography and hardly any people and hardly any money. I mean, there are swathes of America because of a lack of government investment. Hospitals have closed down. Like this has been going on in America for decades.
In California, apparently in Los Angeles County, the ambulance drivers and paramedics have been instructed to make a decision not to pick up people who they don't believe will survive because of the pressure on the hospital system.
Yeah, this is what's happening in LA.
I mean, that's the kind of triaging you see in wartime. That's a wartime kind of decision. And this is now being left to the counties?
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's just like entire communities of people have been abandoned. And the communities of people who are always abandoned, the black, the Hispanic, the sick, that's what's happening in America. But what I find like politically enraging, I mean, I find anything less than social democracy completely enraging, as we all know, is that when Obama, hardly the most like radical bean in the bean farm, our Obama, when Obama was pushing the Obamacare model, you had the Republicans absolutely cutting sick about how, oh, well, there'd be death panels and communists, just like in
Canada,
in Stalinist Russia or in Canada, Justin Trudeau. Also the most radical bean in the bean farm. However, and that there would be death panels and Democrats were bad and universal healthcare was bad because there would be committees sitting there deciding who lived and who died. Ambulance drivers are deciding who lives and who dies because of how many people they can physically carry into hospital. At the same time, you know, vaccines are going here. There are counties who are running GoFundMe pages.
Oh my God.
To try and raise money to run vaccine delivery
programs.
Richest
country in the world, 11 aircraft carriers, most powerful nuclear arsenal in the history of mankind, and their health system has to run GoFundMe pages. Their official health system, not just the people it has bankrupted, but the actual health system itself. And I just to come back to that death panels point, you often hear Americans talk about rationing. So they talk about healthcare rationing in Canada and Australia and the UK. The universal healthcare systems like Medicare result in rationing.
Do they?
I've never had it. But what I have read this week is that they are actually rationing oxygen bottles in America.
Oh, my God.
So you only get so much oxygen and then it's turned off. So 2021, coronavirus is still here. Yes, there is hope with vaccines. Yes, there's probably more hope in Australia because we have much more competent state systems. Our states have been running the hospital systems.
Because we haven't privatised everything. Jeff Kennett gave a pretty good go in Victoria and hence some of the structural problems that hampered us in the first place, that Victoria doesn't have the same health system as New South Wales. And New South Wales was able to run contract tracing and those things because they had a much more integrated, diversified, decentralised health system, which we didn't have. And obviously obviously, I mean, this is the legacy of privatisation. You don't know what you've lost until there's a crisis. Yeah. And fair play, like the Victorian government has worked unbelievably hard to patch up some pretty significant cracks that were there. But we're not out of the woods. No. I mean, this is the thing. Like, we know that that mutant strain has come to Australia because it was picked up.
Yeah.
We know that community transmission is back in New South Wales. We know that idiots like Lyle Shelton think it's really funny to run back and forward over the
state borders
or, you know, make jokes about it or, you know, the police investigate. And as I understand, he won't be charged. But to even be that much of a nincompoop in a public health crisis is just, I mean, you expect nothing more from Lyle Shelton. Like, oh, God. But, I mean, this is the situation is it's still out there and people behaving irresponsibly, people not following the rules, people getting lazy, people saying things like, oh, well, you know, I think we're all a bit done with masks. And I know you and I are both really anxious. Like, so in Victoria, we have a case. He's been diagnosed with coronavirus, who was at the MCG on the day after Boxing Day at the test and who was shopping in Chadstone Mall. Like, I'm not saying that this person is, like, evil or has done anything wrong, but the virus is still in the community. And, of course, quarantine conditions like stay-at-home orders have gone out to people who are in those spaces at those times. And we're not out of the woods
yet. And we know some people ourselves who are in quarantine because of the way they're trying to manage, the states are trying to manage people going from New South Wales to Victoria and so on.
Poor old Sally McManus, who has been out of quarantine for how long? Like 10 minutes?
Yeah,
like
I know. Seems to be in and out of it. Look, I think the big takeaway here is that there's going to be a lot of heavy lifting we're still going to need government to do. And that brings me to the next point that I want to talk about, which is the cuts that have come about in both JobSeeker and JobKeeper in January and that have pushed another 300,000 Australians into poverty.
So coronavirus is still with us.
Still with us.
The virus that at the moment, because the vaccines have not rolled out and it's going to take a while for vaccines to roll out, as we've seen everywhere, because you need millions of them and
billions worldwide.
So, and we know that these mutant strains are occurring. We know they've come into Australia. We know that people have gone to the cricket with coronavirus, which is unfortunate, really. So all the threats to our economy with shutdowns and all of those things are still there. Those fundamental instabilities are still there. And what have they done, Ben? What has Morrison done? What has he done?
Well, he's cut JobSeeker by $400 a fortnight and he's cut JobKeeper by around $200 a fortnight. So that's 1.6 million working people who've had a cut to their income in January. So
these are the JobKeeper recipients?
JobKeeper and JobSeeker.
And JobSeeker.
Have both had cuts. So from the 4th of January, 1.6 million workers have had cuts. There's a study from the ANU which says that around 330,000 Australians will be pushed back into poverty or pushed into poverty for the first time as a result of the cuts, putting a total of about 3.8 million Australians into poverty. So think about that number. I mean, that's a huge number of people.
3.8 million.
Million people. Australian people pushed into poverty. Now, that means that government has made that decision. I cannot fathom how a democratically elected government can decide to push its own people into poverty. We know that unemployment is around 7%. You know, the government tried to make a big song and dance about it dropping slightly in December. Well, some people stopped looking for work because it was Christmas and they thought, well, I'm not going to get a job this close to Christmas anyway. So, yes, it dropped to about 6.8 and it'll come back to about 7 and it'll go up to about 7.2 and maybe it won't quite get to 10. But, you know, 7% of the people who want a job can't get a job. That's what that means.
Oh, people looking for a job.
People looking for a job.
Not actively, people who've given up.
Not people who've given up.
We know that happens. You and I, who've both been unemployed in
Absolutely.
Our time, know that hysteresis is the actual scientific term for the feeling of, like, of being suspended in depression and inactivity, which besets people psychologically when they're unemployed, when they're out of work.
And the longer someone's unemployed, the more likely that is to happen and the less likely they are to get a job. We know that direct government investment in employment is a very strong stimulus to the local economies around the country that will create more jobs, that will mean people hire people.
Which is what we're doing in Victoria. So we're seeing investment all around Victoria with building social housing and investing in various other kinds of infrastructure projects. Out where we live, there's money going into construction around government buildings and hospital upgrades and all these things.
And we know that the impact of the virus is that when people are unwell, they are less likely to spend, they are less likely to create the economic activity that's needed to create jobs. And all you have to do is a comparison between Queensland and Victoria, who've adopted very similar approaches to try and minimise...
Gee, Ben, I wonder what they have in common.
Well, two Labor governments who've tried to minimise the amount of virus to almost to zero as much as they can, and who have stimulated their economies as much as humanly possible, right, to the point of their credit ratings declining slightly in the international money markets, but have put the money in, as you say, to investing in jobs. Now, in Queensland, where they haven't had the outbreaks, they've returned all the jobs. They've returned all the jobs that they lost because they've invested and pushed and pushed and pushed. In Victoria, we've minimised the damage. You haven't seen the damage in Victoria that you've seen in places around the United States, in the UK, in parts of Europe, where those governments didn't adopt that same kind of Keynesian interventionist job-creating model. The danger here, though, of course, is that states can only do so much lifting. Mm. Unlike a Commonwealth government that essentially has an unlimited ability to create taxation and therefore an unlimited ability to borrow, state governments are much more limited. So the Commonwealth has to do the heavy lifting. The Commonwealth has to put money into these creation
but Ben,
of these jobs.
If they're supposed to be doing the heavy lifting, why have they taken the barbells and put them down on the ground? Because that's literally what they've done.
Well, what they're actually doing is they're tying the barbells around people's ankles and they're pushing them into the pool. I mean, that's the big problem here, is that you're going to start to see communities drown. You know, you're going to see people who've already tapped out their super, right? They can't go back to that well again because they've spent, even if the government opened it up again, there's nothing left for a lot of people to access there. People can't get more money on their credit cards. People who've already had deferments on their mortgage payments, in some cases now we're pushing close to 9 months, right? A year, right? People can't do that ad infinitum. The banks simply won't allow it. You've got people who are pushed off paying their rent. You're going to have landlords demanding people start to pay. So without government intervention in all these different parts of the economy, without government spending, without government investment, you're going to see people start to go under. And it's not just the people who, you know, maybe they started a business and took on too much debt and they didn't run it very well. You know, the economy is always going to have those situations, and those people are always going to come and drop out the bottom of any economy, right? And they're hopefully going to find a safety net and they're going to find a place for themselves somewhere else. What we're going to see is the middle part of the economy start to suffer. People who didn't load up on debt when they started off, but during this process have had to take on debt, have had to take on more debt to just keep the doors open or to keep the staff on the payroll, take on deferments of debt mm-hmm. just to keep their own home. They're going to be in real, real strife because these supports are being cut out from under them.
But this is, I mean, you were, I will be honest with our listeners, having a very angry rant about this the other day. The coronavirus actually showed Australians that we have the capacity to solve poverty.
Yeah, exactly right. And we did that.
In this country. And we did that because we increased the amount of Newstart, a job seeker, like became a livable level now, and took enormous amounts of pressure on hundreds of thousands of people.
And I'm not saying that it solved all poverty all around the country for the whole time, but we saw that it can be done. We saw that you can take hundreds of thousands, millions of people out of poverty by direct interventionist government action. Now, what's incredibly frustrating about these cuts to JobSeeker and JobKeeper and the cuts to the support programs that are supposed to be helping the economy
Starve retail and they will starve tourism and they will starve hospitality because we know that's what people stop spending their money on, yeah?
It's that the Morrison government is leaving money in the bank. So they got a big, big check, right, of the budget. The opposition parties, Labor, Greens, everybody said, yes, we need to spend money here. We need to stimulate the economy. We need to support the people of Australia through this crisis until it's over. Not halfway through, not just because we get to Christmas and then we all suddenly feel better about ourselves and it's a bit sunny. Europe had its summer thing too, and now look where it is. Everybody said, here's a big fat check. Look after the people of Australia. The current the current situation is that there's an $11 billion underspend on the budget as a whole. Now, this just goes back to that mentality of the Morrison government. It is a mentality of failure, right? It is the mentality of the secondhand car dealership that you can't spend money to make money. It's all about the cash flow, baby. This is not, it's not real, right? They're leaving $11 billion in the bank that they've got sign off from the parliament to spend on the people of Australia when there are people who need this money, when we could be solving poverty, when we could be lifting people out of poverty, when we could be creating jobs. And it's insanity. These people are there to represent us, to do what's right for the Australian people, to help people, make better lives. How pushing 300,000 people into poverty is helping them have a better life.
But it's ideology, and it's the ideological difference. I mean, and this is the thing when we look at Boris Johnson, when we look at Donald Trump, or we look at Erdogan or Orban or Putin or any of those guys who have embraced the authoritarian capitalist model. Like, the only difference between authoritarian capitalism and centrist capitalism is ambition, really. Yeah. Like, you know, want to go the whole hog, and the authoritarian nature of those guys just blows apart, you know, and makes very clear what the dynamics are. That the ideology around capitalism is not just about money and wealth. Mm. It's about comparison and it's about status. Mm. And the reason why Morrison can just, with a flick of a pen, condemn hundreds of thousands of people to greater poverty, even though they don't have to be there, our society has the means, has the wealth. Clearly, we've been demonstrating the means and the wealth to support everybody. And progressive state governments like Queensland and Victoria have invested in creating opportunities to get people, you know, into work, out of poverty, into supported, like,
into training, education.
Yeah, all these things. Yeah. The issue is that it's not enough to be rich. You have to know that other people are poor.
And
that's the belief system. That's the value system, is that, you know, it's not just about pursuing material comfort. And I think that's the error a lot of people make. Like, we have friends, small business people who vote Liberal because, you know, they think, oh, you know, it's part of your small business, blah, 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 who would be horrified to think that they were implicit in perpetuating the poverty and suffering of other people. But fundamentally, that's what that ideological world stands for, that my wealth is not enough. I can only enjoy my wealth if I know that you don't have it. And not only that you don't have it, that you don't have the means to even acquire it. I mean, I get really outraged with the term welfare net. I don't believe in a welfare net. I believe in a welfare trampoline. You know, somebody wants one of those beautiful aphorisms that old lefties tell you, you know, socialism doesn't limit how high you can fly, it limits how hard you can fall. And I really believe that the point of a welfare state is to allow people to bounce back.
Yeah.
And that it's not just about, like, catching people and keeping them on the ground, like, or just keeping them off the ground, slightly off
bouncing
the ground.
Bouncing them back.
It's about getting them back in the game and providing opportunity. An opportunity for fulfillment and comfort and integration and society and community and all of those things. And you just get so politically frustrated because, you know, I mean, we live in a town of divergent voting opinions, but we know our neighbours and we know our community and we know the people who don't vote the way we do have those values.
Absolutely they do. And I was going to say, and that's exactly the point, you know, over the break, I've spoken with a number of people who I know vote differently to how I would normally vote, but who actually fundamentally share that view, right? And in fact have said to me how disappointed they are in Scott Morrison. You know, they don't want to talk about politics because they've had a gutful of all of them, but most of all they've had a gutful of Scott Morrison. And I think that that's a really...
Given he hardly turns up, like, what's that saying? Like, where's he been? Did you get the news the other day that Scott Morrison was taking a holiday? I was like...
I thought he was already on holiday.
Hasn't he been doing that since March? Didn't he just, like, delegate everything to Daniel Andrews and bugger off?
Somebody said that for a guy who's only had the job for 18 months, he somehow managed to fit in five or six stints of annual leave. Like, I don't know many bosses who give somebody five or six different stints of annual leave, even if it was only for a week at a time. That seems like a lot of annual leave.
I guess, you know, posing for photographs is really taking it out of him.
Well, chicken coop, that was done on work time.
Oh,
don't forget,
knackering.
Chicken coop.
Knackering.
You know, that was work time. That
yeah,
was work
and
time.
You know, all hanging Australians really benefit in that. Do you know what would have been better? Do you know what seriously would have been better? If the Prime Minister had have employed someone to build that chicken coop.
Well, that's
right.
Had
to employed someone to put up Christmas lights. Had to, like, you're the freaking...
Talk about allocation.
Trying so hard not to swear on the iTunes released.
I know. But talk about the allocation of economic resources. Here's the Prime Minister who's paid over $400,000 a year building a chicken coop. Now, surely he could have paid somebody, what's the award for something like that, $25, $26 an hour, maybe $27? I think somehow or another there's a misallocation of economic resources there, Mr. Morrison. So, look, it's incredibly frustrating. It's going to be interesting to see when Parliament comes back. I've heard some really good, I guess, I'm not going to say positive, but good negative stuff coming out of the opposition in the last couple of weeks.
Jed Carney, Jason Clare have been really onto it.
Yeah.
You know, Albanese is talking about this stuff, which is great.
Yeah, starting to
thoroughly
really fire up.
Chris Bowen, of course, is making the links. Like, it's happening and it's visible.
Yeah.
And it's... and what's his face from Footscray? Tim.
Tim Watts.
Had a really great tweet yesterday. What's it? It was Scotty's got a market. Like, he's just got a market. Talking about the fact that rather than creating jobs, rather than paying an Australian award wages to build a chicken coop, he's spending $75 million of taxpayers' money. This is the Prime Minister. On an ad campaign about the coronavirus recovery.
Well, that's the crazy thing, isn't it? There's $11 billion left in the bank, and instead of putting it into JobKeeper and to JobSeeker or into paying Australians to do actual work that needs to actually be done, whether that's a chicken coop or something a bit more substantial.
Like offshore wind or something, maybe build some infrastructure to deal with climate change.
He's going to spend more money on an advertising campaign, which we know, because the records are there, goes to... who does it go to? People like Crosby Textor.
You're not saying that the federal government, the federal Liberal government, spends money...
our money, on Commonwealth money.
Commonwealth money on advertising campaigns run by companies that are Liberal Party donors? You're not saying that,
Liberal
are you?
Liberal Party donors, Liberal Party campaign managers, Liberal Party pollsters, Liberal Party ad makers, they all benefit when Scott Morrison is the Prime Minister. And yet... 1.6 million workers have just had their income cut. 300,000 Australians have just been pushed into poverty.
Scotty's got a market. Oh, my God.
Trademark Tim Watts.
Can I tell you some good news?
Please, let's hear the good news for this week.
They're running... well, I've got some various bits of good news. One of them is in Victoria. The Andrews government is up to one of its devilish schemes, which is, of course, creating opportunities for long-term unemployed people to train as bus drivers.
Fantastic.
And they got a number, they took a couple hundred people into a program to apply and provided all of this sort of peer support around applying for jobs and getting your confidence back and whatever. And they have trained a number of people from the age, I think the youngest is 18 and the oldest is 57. So they're looking at a broad range of different people to get them into those kind of jobs with supported training and create opportunities to overcome long-term unemployment.
Fantastic. That is good news.
That's good news. My other good news is also transport story.
Yep.
Do you want another happy transport
story?
Yeah,
let's hear it.
So Norway, a country beloved of your heart, Ben lived in Norway.
Very, very briefly, but it was a lovely time and the people of Norway will always remain close to my heart and soul.
So Norway...
shout out to Knut Knutsen and Oyvind Svensson. You know, love you guys. Love you so much.
All of Ben's sexy Viking friends. So, and speaking of sexy Vikings, the sexy Vikings of Norway are driving electric cars, and they are not only driving them, they are buying them in huge numbers. 54% of car sales in Norway last year were of electric vehicles.
Fantastic.
And they have a national target of reaching 100% electric vehicle market by 2025, and they've announced that they're going to make it. So all of these... so Norway is a rich country because they didn't privatise their natural resources like Australia did. So their oil reserves made them zillions of dollars, and now, of course, they're transitioning to a zero-carbon economy because they believe in forward planning. I mean, it's just insane. So it's a very wealthy country where citizens are quite wealthy, and they're spending their money on electric cars. So the
interestingly, high tax as well, and yet the people are still very wealthy.
Yes. Yeah. So, and they're buying Teslas in Norway, in the high-taxed country of Norway, where they don't privatise assets. So, the electric car manufacturers are looking at Norway as like the great Western market for development of electric vehicles and are pioneering all of these different models of electric car to sell to the Norwegian market because it's you know, viable and good market. So all of these different kinds of electric cars are coming on the market, are being driven by Norwegians, and they're just racing ahead, I believe we can use the term. And that just makes me so happy. Like, imagine a country that goes to 100% electric vehicle sales. In 10 years, they've gone from 75% of cars being sold in a year being diesel cars. Mm-hmm. So last year, only 8.5% of cars sold in Norway were diesel.
It's quite amazing, isn't it? And Norway is one of those countries where, you know, if you live in Oslo, you can possibly get by without a car. But if you need to leave Oslo and go anywhere else, for anyone who's ever been to Norway, you know, it's a country of mountains and fjords and rivers, and there's something like 52 different dialects there. There's only 3 million people, but something like 52 different dialects.
Because they're so separated
by these natural phenomena, which means you need a car. So often cars are pulled by a family, so you won't necessarily have the Australian model where there's two or three cars to a household, but you might have one car to a household. So these are people who understand their cars, they understand what they're using them for, they understand the kind of distances they need to go. You know, going from Oslo to Tromsø is not a short trip. Have a look at a map if you don't believe me. And you're going to need that kind of range that often, you know, the Morrison government and people who don't like
those cars didn't have great. I mean, I seem to remember before the last federal election when Labor announced an awesome electric vehicle support policy, you know, as a means... I mean, how crazy of, say, reviving the Australian car manufacturing industry, which might be a bit helpful in a world which has these crazy mutant viruses that are shutting down transport everywhere. The issue was that there were slights against the perceived masculinity of people who might be interested in electric cars.
They didn't have the grunt.
You know, real Australian men, you know, like the guys who wear suits and go to cocktail parties at Lachlan Murdoch's house, you know, like, and donate to the Liberal Party and spend their money on ad campaigns, you know, like real bronzed Aussies. Yeah, that real men wouldn't drive electric cars. And I was thinking of your Norwegian friends. I was thinking of Knut Knutsen and maybe Magnus and, you know, and Morten. And maybe the cast of, say, like Norseman, which was a show that we also got into. And imagining Scott Morrison going up to those guys and questioning, you know, their masculinity based on their choice of electric vehicle. And I couldn't really, I mean, Norwegians are pretty reasonable and probably, you know, find it interesting.
Oh, they're all lovely. They are all
conversational
lovely.
Way around it, but I just thought, yeah, that is really disgusting. And electric vehicles, people of Norway, and Knut Knutsen for the win.
Absolutely. That is the week on Wednesday, our first episode back for 2021.
It's so great to be back in the shed.
Our
dog is still cute.
He is very cute. He's been running around a little bit today.
Which is good because he had a knee injury, listeners, and Ben and I were beside ourselves.
It was very sad. But he's all right now. Oh, the important thing is Germanicus is okay.
He's totally fine. He's made a 100% recovery and he's as cute as a bean.
Now, don't forget to share this episode. You'll find it on wherever you found it and are listening to it now. But make sure you share it on all of your platforms, your Facebook, your Twitter, your Instagram. If you use TikTok or Snapchat or any of those
things that young people do that Ben and I don't really understand, please promote the show.
We haven't really got to those, but do share them, do talk about them. Let us know if you have any questions. Let us know if you have any ideas or any issues. We want to thank everyone for their feedback over the break as well.
Oh, we really appreciated all the messages. You know, like, we took our 2 weeks off and people were like, when are you coming back? And we were like, we love you. We'll be back. We're coming back. We've just got to cook the turkey.
And hopefully the messages about the background noise of our phones buzzing, we put them on airplane mode this week. So hopefully you haven't heard any of those.
Media professionals, Van Batterman, Ben Davis. Oh my God, I am a media professional.
I know, right? That's the week on Wednesday, everyone.
It's good to be back, Benny. I love you.
Love you too, Vanny.